everyone. Welcome to the Curiosity Cast, a place where we explore a variety of topics, meet interesting people, and follow our curiosity wherever it takes us. I'm your host, Allie Merrill, and thanks for tuning in. Today's guest is Holly Nelson. She and her husband, Eric, moved to Lusaka, Zambia 10 years ago to start an organization for kids with intellectual disabilities called Special Hope Network. They moved there with their three kids who they adopted, who all have Down syndrome, and she's just an amazing human being who I'm really excited for you to learn more about. Here she is. Tell me a little bit about what Special Hope is for people who haven't heard of it before.
So Special Hope is a 501c3 in the U.S., which means it's a nonprofit, but it's also a Christian ministry, and that was started basically because God called us here from unrest with our life in America and what we were doing and really feeling like God was calling us to something different. And so my husband Eric, in praying, he just knew that we were supposed to be in Africa because the need for work with kids with disabilities was so great here. In the U.S., our three children have an intellectual disability, and they were given free school program, free medical care, and things like glasses and other needs that they had. And some kids in the U.S. even get respite care and other things provided for them. Where in Africa, none of that happens. If kids are allowed to go to school or there are enough classrooms, that would be amazing. But then to add good medical care and provisions like glasses or diapers or other things like that on top of it is just unheard of. So he felt like in praying that we were supposed to come to Africa. So to make a very long story short, he came and went to five different countries. The need was in every country. Every country said, yes, please come. We need you. And he talked with people from mission organizations to government, to schools, to orphanages in each one of these countries. And the need was great in each country. So at the time, the one organization, a Christian organization here in Zambia, said, if you come to Zambia, we'll place one home out of every 10 on our villages will be for kids with disabilities. So it seemed very clear that we were supposed to start in Zambia. Mm-hmm. They rented a house for us, for missionaries that were away in the U.S. They loaned us a car. They helped us get started finding some of the first organizations, and then we just went from there. And so Zambia was picked because it felt handpicked by God. It was an English-speaking country for our kids with disabilities to be able to function. And then this mission organization was willing to help us get started. So now we're an NGO here in Lusaka, Zambia, as well as a 501c3 in the U.S., but solidly a Christian ministry, supported more than 70% by faithful monthly donors in the U.S. And they are faithful. We've had people look at our organization's financial work and say, this is incredible. You know, you have such a higher rate of monthly supporters than other organizations we see. And I think that's because for families that have a family member with a disability, they see the need. They see how much that family member benefits from love and care and school and medical care and a little extra and how incredibly hard that would be in a third world or non-developed world country like Zambia or the neighboring countries like Malawi or Zimbabwe or Namibia. So our donors are incredibly faithful, which then gives us the ability to serve here without always thinking about fundraising, which is nice.
Can you describe what your locations are, or at least what a community care center is that might be most helpful?
So most of our work and the heart of our work is done at community care centers in very densely populated compounds. Don't picture a compound like a walled, lovely golf course sort of a compound in America, but you're picturing a very densely populated dirt ground, very small cement brick homes area of Lusaka. And people are basically living right on top of each other. You can hear what your neighbors are doing. And there are thousands of people in a square mile. And so we have put community care centers in the middle of those. And we tried to pick ones that are somewhat the most needy and also close to our head office so that we're not driving far and using lots of gas because the fuel here is a lot more expensive than the US. Mm-hmm. So in those community care centers, parents come with their child with an intellectual disability. So if they also have a physical disability, they're welcome to come. But if they don't have an intellectual disability, then we send them to other ministries or other organizations that serve kids with physical disability only. And we do that because there are more organizations that focus their work on people with physical disability and not intellectual disability. So our kids have autism, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, micro and hydrocephaly, and other genetic disorders that are one-off or a little more frequent than that. So the parents come with their child or caregiver comes with their child. Sometimes it's a big sister. Sometimes the parents have died and it's a grandma. And the person that comes is the one who's trained for every single aspect of that child's life. So the parent feels equipped to advocate on behalf of their child for what the child needs when they go to the clinic or when they're out and about going to the market. If somebody makes fun of them, they know the right words to say. And the parent learns how to teach motor skills, communication skills, academic skills, interaction skills, and just some basics. Like it's a Zambian thing that if a child doesn't walk, they're in a piece of fabric called a chitenge on your back. But it's a radical thing to say, what if you put that child on your front and chat with them instead of having them on your back? Mm-hmm. And so it's really simple changes like that that are easy for a parent to change, but that they wouldn't think of without Special Hope there to do some parent training and teach them about how they really can teach their child for life. Because they feel like they've been told this child will amount to nothing. This child is a cabbage. This child is a vegetable. This child will be nothing. You should take this child out to the bush and leave him. And we want this mom to be able to say, no, no, this child was given to you by God. This is a child that is worthy of your time, your effort, your love, your care. And this child is valued and worth more than what the people around you are telling you. And by serving these families and going to their homes, when our social workers or our managers go to their homes to visit, the neighbors are spoken to and trained and taught so that our goal is that within 10 years, we would have 7 disability inclusive communities. Because right now, no community is inclusive. No full compound is welcoming to a child with an intellectual disability. And if you're not a fierce mama who is ready to speak on behalf of your child, going out with your child is always hard. Even just going to the clinic for a vaccination, you're in a huge long line with all these moms who have typically developing kids, and they're making fun of the kids with disabilities. So we'll advocate on behalf of our kids and ask the clinic to set up a time just for our moms and kids to go for their vaccinations. And they'll go and they'll make a lineup of the typical line is now everyone in the line is a mom of a child with an intellectual disability. And they're laughing and they're talking and they're having fun together. And so we're slowly, it's changing culture. It's taken 10 years. I'm sure it'll take another 30 or 40, probably the rest of my lifetime and then some, because it's more like the U.S. was in the 1950s, before the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's just still thought that you can catch an intellectual disability or any disability. It's contagious. So people don't want to touch a child or a family, because if the family's cursed and I touch that family and I catch the curse, that would be awful. So that needs to change.
Yeah.
Slowly.
What initially sparked your passion for working with kids with intellectual and physical disabilities?
I loved working with kids, and I was always in the church nursery, and I was always the teenager that was babysitting in my neighborhood and the youth group person that everybody in the church asked to come babysit. And I just loved kids. So if there were kids around, that's where I was. So then my first job was at a shoe store in Princeton, New Jersey. And there was a family that came in with a little girl with Down syndrome. And I didn't know what Down syndrome was at the time. She was absolutely adorable to me. Soft, silky blonde hair, round face, blue eyes, cute as a button. And I was coming out from the back of the shoe store where the shoe boxes were, and the people that own the shoe store and work there, like their family members, were going to the back and complaining that this family was here again with this kid. Mm. And so I said, well, I'll go and be with them. That's no problem. And I could see her, and I thought, what's the big deal? So I went and I worked with this little girl whose feet were very flat and very fat and short. And since now that I have three kids with Down syndrome, I totally get this, how difficult it is finding good shoes. We tried on shoe after shoe after shoe after shoe, and we found her the right little stride right wides. I can even picture them today. So God must have imprinted that into my brain. And I went home, and my parents used to talk with me at mealtime a lot about, well, what is God calling you to do? Is it all kids? Is it just young kids? Is it really young kids, like ones that need help learning everything? Or is it the age where you're learning how to read? And I just remember having really good conversations about things like that with my dad. Mm-hmm. And so he was driving me at the time. I must have been 16 because I wasn't driving yet. And we were driving home that day, and I remember talking with him, and he said, well, you need to work on it. The next job needs to be with kids with disabilities before you're choosing a college, so that you know what type of program you want to be in. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure if I went back in time, they would know that I wasn't a great academic, but I was great with my hands. And he could see that I was going to have a job that was more practical than mm-hmm. a job that was like being a scientist or something like that. So at that time I took a job at a summer camp for kids with autism, and I worked with kids with pretty serious autism way back when it was called pervasive developmental delay. And that was also in Princeton, New Jersey. And it was a really specialized school. And I learned so much that summer, that I realized that this was what I wanted to do in college. So I went to school, got my degree in early childhood education and moderate to severe disabilities. And then when I graduated, there was a glut of teachers. I mean, there were so many teachers. There were like 300, 350 teachers for one job. And so I got a job with kids with special needs right off the bat, because there are fewer teachers always that want to do special education than typically developing kids. And so for the last 31 years, I've been working with kids with special needs. And so I have the typical degree, the early childhood regular degree, to know general development, but also the special needs degrees to know teaching methods and working with kids with special needs. My husband and I adopted three kids with Down syndrome, which was not the plan. Infertility is never in the plan for when you get married. You know, you don't think that will be the plan, but infertility was definitely part of God's plan for us. And so after 5 years of infertility, we started talking about adoption. And during that time, there were very few children available for adoption. And there were a lot of abortions happening in America. So the price for a white, healthy infant was approximately $25,000. And at the time, I was making under $20,000 a year as a teacher.
Wow.
And my husband was in seminary. So we were paying seminary bills. So that was not an option. So we started talking about the value of a life. What color? What type? And we realized we didn't think that God valued white, healthy infants more than biracial, black, or any other color or type of disability at all. Mm. So then we just opened our eyes to what kids were out there, who needed a home, and we realized that it was sibling groups of color with a disability. So we adopted our girls, twins who were Afro-Brazilian, and then their brother is totally Brazilian, but lighter skinned, but also disability, and all three of them had medical needs. So from there, we learned so much more about disability by having kids with disability in our house. And then it made me regret that I had told parents things as a teacher before I was a parent of kids with disabilities. And I learned how the value of living what you're teaching other people. Mm. So our kids are now 27 and 25, and or almost 27. The girls will be 27 in May. And so we've had the all day, all night training of them, plus my degree. And then Eric's degree is in in theology. So he works with the ministry level governmental parts of the working with Zambia, which you need in order to make change. You need somebody who can speak to, has the gray hair and is respected, because if you look older in this culture, you are naturally respected. And then he has the ability to speak from scripture, the value of a life, and why it's important that a country like Zambia that calls itself a Christian nation will value a life of a person with disabilities as much as a typically developing person who will rise up and maybe be a doctor or a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. How did the kids do with the transition from America to Zambia? Because a lot of things changed for them when you guys made that move 10 years ago.
Yeah. Thankfully, they are people. So as long as their people don't change, they are very happy. So because we went from both of us working full time, and my husband was working two jobs and I was working two jobs to make ends meet in America, we weren't seeing each other very often. And so then they got us all the time. So they were really happy. And we went everywhere with them as soon as we got to Zambia, which they loved. And the weather was beautiful because we arrived in May and rainy season had just ended and everything was green and flowers are blooming and we could eat outside. So at first it was great. And then they started missing people, and they started missing Chipotle, and they started missing American church and their friends. And so there was lots of asking, when are we going to see them again? Because they thought it was a trip, because we had traveled before that. Now they have this great life carved out for them, where they have this huge fan club on two continents. We can Skype people in America that love them and will be ridiculous with them over Skype or Zoom, singing with them and talking with them. But they have this team of people here that take care of their needs during the day and push them to greater skills while we work. So Eric and I work full-time out of our office, which is at our resource center, which is our tuition-based special education school. And they are all three home, and they do jobs. They wash dishes, put dishes away. They do laundry with people, and they fold clothes and put the laundry away in the right places. Sam is gardening. He's raking. He's composting. He's as much as they can do, we're pushing them to do with the people that are with them. So right now they're sad because of COVID-19. It's just mom and dad and the three of them and our dogs in our home and our wall fence here. But we do Skype our friends that are normally with them during the day that are missing them.
I wanted to get the feel for how Special Hope is doing, and you've talked about that a little bit. But can you tell me what people's biggest needs are right now, and are you still serving the families of Special Hope? What's going on there because of the coronavirus would be one of.
Okay, so we are still serving our kids, but we're not allowed to have kids coming to the programs, just like in the U.S., because of the risk for kids and the risk for teachers and having everybody on minibuses coming to and from work. So somewhere, I could go back and look at the date, but somewhere right around March, the last week of March, we were mandated to stop all programs with children. So at that point, we told our staff to stay home and we would still pay them. And the kids needed to start staying home with their families. And we explained how contagious this virus is, but they weren't hearing anything about it. So our moms and our kids didn't really know how serious it was. So then it started becoming slowly put out in the news how dangerous it is and how to protect yourself. But if you think about the realities of how small these houses are, you were in them, right?
Yeah, they're small.
You can't get
and no private bathroom.
No. So you're sharing a bathroom outside, and each room isn't even 2 meters across, and then it may have 6 or 8 people in it. So if one person's sick, everybody's going to be sick. And if you don't have running water, and certainly you don't have money to buy hand sanitizer, because here in this country it is a lot more expensive than in America. I went to buy one that's probably like this size, so 500 milliliter size.
Like a Sprite bottle.
Yeah, 165 Kwacha, which is
oh my gosh,
over $10. And so if you're doing it and because you don't have running water, you're going to use that in 2 days. And mm-hmm. you only may make 500 kwacha a month. So you're not going to spend it on that enough food. Mm-hmm. So the markets aren't, some of them aren't allowed to be open. Some are. You're supposed to be social distancing, but how can you really do that in a market? Mm-hmm. And there's no running water at markets. It's hard to keep them clean. So there are a couple things that the experts think are keeping Zambia from exploding like in the US. And so they're trying to do research to figure out how much of these are actually the case. One is that the entire population is younger. So in the US, healthcare is better, people live longer. There are a lot more people that are over 50 in America. Mm-hmm. Where here, the median age, last time I heard it, was 43, 44, somewhere in there. So I'm an old lady. And there aren't a lot of people that I see on a daily basis over 70. Now, they may be in their homes, they may be being taken care of by family, but there is a very young populace in Zambia. Okay. The second thing is that they think there's some protection from the BCG vaccination, which is done in some countries around the world, and Zambia is one of them. So if you've had that vaccination, well, I should go back. So the World Health Organization is trying to figure out why some countries are getting socked with COVID less than others. Yeah. The US does not do the BCG vaccination, and it's been really bad in the US. The countries that do get that vaccination are having many less people get it and many less people die. So they're trying to figure out, is there a link or not? Is it just something else? So because it's required here, they think that if that is a protection, then that's also keeping the spread of it down, because then those of us that come from countries that don't have it aren't getting exposed to people that do have it because they had the vaccination.
Right.
And our kids are from Brazil. They had it in Brazil.
Okay.
So they're good.
Okay.
And then it's not very international. So as soon as they realized it was coming in, flying in from other countries, and they closed the airport and they started quarantining people, we now are at 45 people sick, 2 have died, mm-hmm. and all of them can be traced to people that flew in from outside the country.
Okay.
So if they close the borders in time, then they think if they isolate these groupings that it won't spread. Mm-hmm. But if it does spread, if it gets into the compounds, it's going to be really bad for our kids, and it's going to be really bad for our moms, because many of our moms are single parents with multiple kids in a home. And so when they whisk in and do the check and take the children or whoever sick out of the home, if the mom is the only adult and they take that mom, who's going to care for the kids with disability? Mm-hmm. So we have our social workers calling the kids every other day, and the managers are also calling kids and moms every other day. So they're hopefully getting a call every day to check in on them, that they're okay, that they're washing their hands, that they're staying home, that they're not having other people come visit their house. Because, you know, Zambian culture, people go and they sit and they visit and they pluck the leaves for the dinner together while sitting around the bucket, putting the stems in there and chatting away. Well, that's not 2 meters apart, and then you're touching everybody's food.
Yeah.
So our programs have completely stopped, but all of the executive staff are currently working. So the American staff is writing parent trainings and doing the trainings for the full 2-year program that we've changed over the community care centers to be doing. So a parent signs in and then they're in for 2 years. And by the end of that 2 years, they'll get a certificate of all that they learned for their child, and then they're signed out. So the hope is that it creates a sense of urgency, like a diploma. I'm only doing this for this time. It's not for all time. Because we're having problems with attendance. We're having problems with people moving to different compounds. And they would only be there for a little while and then they'd leave. So this urgency that it creates hopefully will keep them there so they can learn all they need to learn for their child and then move on.
Can you tell me why it's so important to train the parents, mm-hmm. especially within your 2-year program now too? Like, why is that so important?
So the parents are the most crucial person to change the child's life. If I know what to do for my child's development and how to get them accepted into society and how to speak and advocate on their behalf, then their life will change. But if I just go to a place where I know they're accepted and those people will be nice to my kids, then it doesn't change my life and it doesn't change community and it doesn't change Zambia. Mm-hmm. But 300 or 400 or 500 moms that are advocating for their kids and pushing bus drivers to let their kids on the bus and pushing police officers to care about their kids in a situation where they may not have cared in the past, that will make a big difference in Zambia and it will change culture. Mm-hmm. Where us coming in and just being a nice place for them is nice. Everybody likes a club where you're accepted, but it doesn't do long-term change. And the two-year program, creating that sense of urgency, is showing them there are things that you need to learn about your child. And they fall into these categories. There are self-help skills, which are really important in Zambia because here it's loving to do everything for someone else. And that's not loving for a child with disability. If I give my kids a bath and I help them put their undies on and I help them put their nightie on and I help them put their lotion on and they're not doing any part of it, they're never going to learn. So right. Self-help skills are important for the child with disability or the young adult with disability to learn independence and to grow. And so parents here need to learn that it's actually loving to teach your child independent skills and not to do everything for them. Okay. So the training program will have all of these different steps in it so that by the time they finish, they'll have everything from communication skills, motor skills, academics, pre-academics, whatever their child needs to learn.
In the time that you've been there, how many years has it been that you guys have been there now?
You should ask. May 1st is 10 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
And we're at April 15th, 15th, 16th. Yeah, we're almost, we're two weeks away.
So if you can just briefly touch on, we don't have to go into depth, but maybe how the culture was when you guys first arrived 10 years ago and having very few, if any, programs for kids with special needs. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that?
No, I was just actually writing them down this week. So when we arrived in May of 2010, we went to all the organizations that accepted kids with intellectual disabilities or physical disabilities, whether it's schools or orphanages or clinics, and there were less than 10. Then we went to an organization that had a list of the schools that had special needs units, which means that it's a government school that has a wing of the school that accepts kids with special needs. And there were less than 10 on that in a city of millions and millions of people. So you can imagine that that's not even scratching the surface of what the need is in this city. So there was also a lack of acceptance or understanding. We would go to a mall or a grocery store and everyone would absolutely stop what they were doing and stare at our family and not be able to shop or do anything. I mean, the funniest time ever was that we were walking along a sidewalk in Lusaka in the middle of the city, and a man, we were stopped and he was walking and he walked straight into a street light pole because he was staring so much at us he never even saw the pole coming. And that kind of thing doesn't happen as much. We're still stared at, people still make comments, but it's really changed. There are more programs, there are more advocacy that's out and about because technology has changed a lot in 10 years. So Facebook is free for Zambians. So many Zambian citizens have Facebook on their phone and they're able to look at things that are on there. So there are a few organizations for kids with autism that are grassroots organizations started by moms. There's one for children with cerebral palsy. The hospital Bait Cure has a parent group. And so there's just more and more and more acceptance and it created kind of a groundswell. It's not coming from government level down, though Eric is on a subgroup from the government that is, it sounds like they want to do some change, but most of the groundswell is coming up from moms starting something neat in their compound for kids with disabilities. And usually it's one type of disability or physical disability. And there aren't many organizations like us that do only intellectual disability or network with others to help point people in the right direction. So we try to keep a running list of what organizations are out there and what they're doing so that when someone calls us and they need something, we can point them in the right direction.
Okay. When you guys were first thinking of Special Hope and kind of dreaming it up and then making it happen, did you have specific goals that you wanted to accomplish or like a milestone you wanted to hit to say, okay, we've done this thing, or do you have that now? I don't know how that's maybe changed over time too.
It's changed over time. So when we came, we had no idea what God was calling us to. We knew that He was calling us to Zambia to work with kids with intellectual disabilities because the need was so great, but we didn't know what that looked like or where. So part of going to these organizations that first year we were here was to interview them and find out, what are your needs? Mm-hmm. What would make you stronger? Where do you see gaps in service model around Zambia, and how can we meet that need? And so by the end of the first year here, we could see that the need was in every community, in every compound, there were hundreds of kids with disabilities. So we needed to do something that was local in those communities. Mm. But then we didn't know what that would look like. We started going to kids' homes and doing one at a time, and then finding more kids and having those kids go to that home and using the parents' home. But that quickly got too big for each home, because if your home is one room and you have five moms and five kids with disabilities and one staff member from us, the room is way too full. You don't even have room for the furniture. So then rainy season came and we had to figure something out. So we started using local schools at that point and using the school buildings after their programs were done. And that worked for a time as well. So at the time we thought, oh, we'll set up something in 3 years and then move on to another country.
Okay.
But then we realized, 3 years, we are so not ready to leave this in other people's hands yet. It was just starting. Everything was just beginning, and we were realizing what parents needed and how we could better serve them and tweaking everything as we went. So we'd try something and then we'd make a change, and we'd try something else and we'd make a change. So here we are 10 years later. No way are we leaving Zambia at this time. Mm-hmm. But other Southern African countries do need something like this. So mm-hmm. we're in contact with groups in Malawi and groups in Zimbabwe, and there's need everywhere. Mm-hmm. But you really need good people to be able to leave the work in their hands. And we have good people, but we don't have enough to leave with if all the international staff pulled out right now.
One thing that you guys provide is funerals. Is that still, do you all still do that? Can you just maybe talk about why you provide that service of a funeral?
The average lifespan of a child in Zambia is pretty short. So a while ago, we had a number, and we're trying to figure out if this number is still accurate, but 80% of kids die by their fifth birthday. So the statistic is scary when you think about kids with disabilities. There are so many ways that a child with an intellectual disability can have their medical scenario put at risk. It could be from swallowing, choking, not good medical care because a child goes to the clinic to get cared for something like hydrocephaly and their head is huge and they're saying they have a headache and they're sent home with one Panadol, which is like a Tylenol, and said, oh, he'll be fine. Well, he's not going to be fine until the shunt is put in. So the medical care here puts that child at risk. And then because they don't get the shunt, they lose their vision, or they lose their balance, or they lose their hearing, or they die. So the risks for kids here are really severe. And because parents don't understand that, and parents aren't the American personality where you question doctors, I mean, you do not question doctors here. It doesn't matter what the doctor says to you. The doctor could say, your child is green, and they're going to be green for life, and then they're going to turn purple at age 3. People would go, okay, thank you. And they would never question that. Mm. So we've had parents say, oh yeah, my child died after getting an injection at the clinic. And so our social workers have said, what was the injection? Oh, I don't know. Well,
wow.
The culture of not questioning those in authority puts our kids at risk. Because what if that clinical officer didn't have a great heart? Maybe they did have a great heart. Maybe the That was a shot that was totally to help the child and had nothing to do with it. But we've heard it too many times to not question, is this something to do away with that child? So there are so many ways that a child can be, their health can be put at risk that has nothing to do with their disability. But because they have a disability, they're so much more at risk to not make it to age 5. Many of our kids, the family attends a church and the church doesn't even know the child exists, because the family locks the child away at home and goes to church because it would be against their theology to have a child with a disability. Because if you have faith and you pray for a child to get well, and you're in a prosperity gospel sort of church, and that child isn't healed, well, then your faith is not strong enough, or the family curse is too strong. So if the child doesn't get healed, which any disabilities will not have happen, I mean, God can do whatever he wants and he can heal in an instant, but he often chooses not to. And so if he chooses not to, we should still be taking our children to church and treating them as special by God, as a creation that is made in his image. So when the child dies, the church family often doesn't know that the child even existed. So they often don't want the church to know. And so we run the whole funeral. We have either Eric or Dennis preach. We provide the songs. We provide the staff to sing and be part of it. And all the moms come. It is so heartwarming. So the family feels supported. The coffin is purchased by Special Hope, or transport, or food. The amount we give is not a huge amount, but with so many kids dying, we just frankly can't give more than we give. So we give approximately $60. They already have so little. And so this stipend is to help them with coffin, transport, food, and to feel cared for, to feel like this child was valued. And as many of our staff go to the funerals as humanly possible, go. Okay. So as things happen, often it's on a Monday, Wednesday, or Friday when our programs are running, and then we only have 2 or 3 people go. But there are times when it's on a Saturday or Sunday, and as many people go as possible.
What would be most helpful during COVID-19 and also just kind of with Special Hope Network moving forward from here?
So I think our greatest need at this point is to get the word out that Special Hope is here, because the only thing that's holding us back is international staff coming here to work with us, and finances or support and prayers, and churches jumping on board to regularly pray for us. So we've exhausted all of the people that we, Eric and I, and our family know through our lifetime. But there's social media, and there's all of these donors that are supporting us monthly. And so right now we're looking for an ambassador for Special Hope Network in each state. And if we have an ambassador or 2 or 3 in each state that would be willing to constantly be sharing the news of Special Hope for corporate social responsibility, for businesses that might be in their state, or for churches that might take on Special Hope as a missions thing, not just for sending money, but for telling their people, because the people in those churches are those that are going to raise up kids like me, that are going to love kids with special needs, that are going to want to come serve. And if there's this big pot of teachers in the world and only a small percentage of those love kids with disabilities, there's even a smaller percentage of those that are going to want to move to Zambia and work with us. So I think getting the word out in multiple ways is our biggest need, because the variety of things that would bring our way would be really great. And we could just focus our attentions here.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Curiosity Cast. For more content and episodes, you can visit www.thecuriositycast.com or follow us on Instagram @thecuriositycast. Stay curious.